Well, welcome to Spoiler Alert. Once again, I am Steve.
And I'm Andre, and today we are talking about one of our favorite filmmakers, Martin Scorsese.
The underrated.
The underrated, and of course we're driving around appropriately through the grimy, filthy streets of Chicago suburbs, and just waiting for the real rain to come, Steve.
That's
and
right.
Wash all the filth away.
So if you're Travis Bickle, am I Peter Boyle?
Yes, or you're that crazy character Scorsese himself played.
I'm the racist man trying to kill his adulterous wife.
That's right, the cuckold. Nobody wants that, so let's just maybe get away from that analogy. I'm no Travis Bickle, and you're no crazed Scorsese character.
As far as you know.
And that's so far. Who knows where we'll get by the end of our journey. But, you know, with Scorsese, of course, so much has been said about the man. But, I mean, what do you like about Scorsese? Just right off the bat.
Scorsese movies always feel... This will sound vague, but you can feel that there's a passion going on behind the camera. The energy of a Scorsese film, both in the camera movement, the music cues. It's a very visceral style of filmmaking. And I know these are all vague terms that critics throw around a lot, but you feel energized watching a Scorsese film. You rarely feel put to sleep. You just feel the excitement of the movies.
Absolutely. For me, it's just, you know, Scorsese at his best, and, you know, we could, of course, discuss what Scorsese at his best is, but at his best, it's, you know, he has a very, very strong voice as a filmmaker, very unique voice as a filmmaker. The guy, you know, a Scorsese movie feels like a Scorsese movie most of the time. And there are certainly exceptions, and we'll talk about those, but you always feel like that little kid from Little Italy who didn't have a lot of friends growing up, who was kind of abused by his siblings and was a sickly little kid and just kind of found escape in the dark movie theater like you and I did as well, I would imagine, Steve. And,
sure.
And just developed a deep love for the art form from a very early age, kind of became an encyclopedia of film knowledge, and just instantly knew that that's what he wanted to do, that's the field he wanted to go into, and pursued it with just an enormous amount of energy, an enormous amount of passion. Of course, he went to NYU, I believe, right? The same school you went to.
He sure did.
That's yes. Right. And did you ever meet Scorsese, Steve?
I never did. When I was there, Scorsese, I'm not sure if he ever taught there. He certainly gives a lot of money to the school and contributes, you know, mostly money. He did not come to screen anything when I was there. He had come a couple of years before, and I was told it could be a little underwhelming because Scorsese is such a god among film geeks that there were rigorous presidential levels of security around Scorsese. You know, do not hand Mr. Scorsese a piece of a screenplay. Do not feed Mr. Scorsese any raw meat. Do not bring up, you know, your favorite gangster moment of a Scorsese film. I mean, I'm sure the man, from everything I've seen, I can't imagine he wouldn't be an entertaining speaker. But fortunately, I did not. I neither got to meet nor see him talk during my time there.
Well, me neither. I do not know Martin Scorsese, but I certainly read a lot about him. I've seen all of his films, and I feel that I'm qualified to criticize Scorsese and be occasionally lacerating to some of his work. But early on, I just want to kind of jump into his earliest work. I guess his first feature was a movie called Who's That Knocking on My Door with Harvey Keitel.
Made when he was still a student, I believe.
That's right. He started the film when he was still a student. The film took 4 years to complete. I mean, he was shooting that. There was a nude scene in the film that he tacked on, essentially, very, very late, like 4 years after he started principal photography. If you watch the film carefully, Harvey Keitel kind of changes throughout the course of that film a little bit. And in one scene, he seems just a little bit more mature than he does in some of the other scenes. It's kind of interesting.
Well, that was a film made back when Scorsese was no more a known filmmaker than you or I or anyone listening to this.
Exactly, exactly. Very.
No one's giving him money off that. No one thinks he's worthy of it. So he decides to make a movie anyway.
Yeah, and you know, obviously it shows an enormous amount of passion when somebody, you know, believes in something so strongly that it takes him 4 years to complete. And you know, while in school, Scorsese, of course, idolized, and this is what I read, I mean, his two main influences as far as individual films is he loved Citizen Kane, Orson Welles' masterpiece, of course, and John Cassavetes' Faces. And upon the initial release of Who's That Knocking on My Door, John Cassavetes saw the film and was stunned by it. John Cassavetes, upon seeing Who's That Knocking on My Door, supposedly said that this film is better than Citizen Kane. It has more passion. It's more personal. And, you know, you can only imagine what, you know, what words like that meant to a young Martin Scorsese from, you know, his hero, John Cassavetes, who went on, of course, to kind of adopt Scorsese a little bit and was very supportive to his early career.
Well, so Scorsese made, you know, Who's That Knocking at My Door? He made a film for Roger Corman called Boxcar Bertha, and supposedly after that, Mr. Cassavetes encouraged Scorsese that he shouldn't waste his talents on just any old crap. He should make films that are personal to him. And voila, we have what is technically the third feature film Martin Scorsese directed, which a lot of people still mistakenly think of as his debut, Mean Streets.
That's right, Mean Streets. And you know, in Mean Streets, we, you know, arguably have the Martin Scorsese that we all know and love, essentially kind of really, really finding his voice. I mean, Scorsese hated Boxcar Bertha. To this day, he does not like the film. He finds it exploitive and, you know, it's just, you know, it was done for money. It was done with Roger Corman, who he worked with before, who he also idolized, who was very helpful to young filmmakers, but it was not a personal film. So doing Mean Streets, Scorsese just kind of gets into the area that he knows, that he knows and loves. It's a New York film. It again stars Harvey Keitel, who at this point Scorsese really believed was going to be his acting partner.
His guy.
And it also stars the young Robert De Niro, who actually ended up being his guy in, you know, down the line, but you know, very raw film. I mean, this is sort of this kind of a punk rock movie. If you really, really watch Mean Streets and you know, and kind of watch it with fresh eyes, because certainly since then, you know, whenever you watch any film that was revolutionary in its era, it's always a bit of a letdown, because when a movie's really revolutionary, it's been imitated so many times.
Yes, when something, you know, to use a cliche, when something changes the game and you're seeing it years later, then the game's been changed. And many movies since that movie have incorporated a lot of the stylistic tropes that Mean Streets developed. And so now you watch it and you're like, oh, well, you know, I've seen that a gazillion times since. Sometimes I've seen it done better.
Exactly, and it's been done better by Scorsese himself. But you know what you have in Mean Streets is a very cool approach to filmmaking, which is very un-Hollywood. And you know, this is early 70s, and Hollywood is kind of going through a lot of changes at that time, where all of a sudden there are producers working in Hollywood that don't seem to be overly concerned with making money, making slick Hollywood product, and actually seem interested in making art. So Scorsese, who, amongst other things, is extremely influenced by Italian neorealism from, you know, post-World War II era, and French New Wave from the early 1960s, late 50s to some extent, arguably. And this really, really comes to the fore in Mean Streets, which is really, it's very raw. It has a lot of what seems to be kind of pseudo-improvisational stuff. It has, you know, it has a rough look to it. The art direction is very, you know, it's not pretty to look at, and the characters are arguably very unlikable. You know, even the main character Harvey Keitel does some very, very bizarre things in that movie that, you know, up to that point you wouldn't really see protagonists engage in, and certainly De Niro's character Johnny was, you know, is just a creep. The guy is, you know, is a borderline psychotic, which is another thing you don't see a lot. Especially in a way that's not particularly judgmental of him. You know, it's just, that's just him, and that's how he acts, and it's true to the guys that live in that world. And that movie, of course, put Scorsese on the map. I mean, when people saw that film, boom, it was obvious that this was a major, major talent. And that, of course, got him hired to do his next film, which is Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. And Ellen Burstyn, who was an Oscar winner at that time, very, very successful actress, had, you know, was doing this film, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and she saw Mean Streets and said, that's the guy that's got to direct this film, somebody who's really, you know, really has a unique approach to cinema. And at that time, of course, Mean Streets was really, really unique. It was completely original. So they get into Alice, and, well, what can you say? Have you seen Alice lately, Steve?
So,
you have not seen Alice.
That's the type of homework I'm prepared to do for this podcast.
Excellent.
I have never seen Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Well, you know, I haven't seen Alice Does Not Live Here Anymore for quite a few years, but I do like the film. It's a very solid film. You know, the interesting thing on that film was just sort of Scorsese getting a taste of what it's like to do other people's projects. And, you know, the story on that film was that there was actually a fairly difficult relationship between him and Ellen Burstyn, who was technically his boss on the film. And, you know, there is a couple of interesting stories that come out of that movie, particularly, well, you know, Kris Kristofferson, who was a friend of Marty's, even before the film, was the leading man in the film, and he wasn't a very experienced leading man. And one story goes that at one point, that you know, they shot a whole bunch of stuff and scenes, particularly between Burstyn and Kristofferson. And Burstyn afterwards mentioned to Scorsese that she actually did a little coaching and told Kristofferson, you know, what to do in certain scenes, which absolutely infuriated Scorsese, and he actually reshot all of those scenes. So all this, so there were like, I think, three scenes where Ellen Burstyn gave minor direction to Kris Kristofferson. Scorsese insisted on reshooting them without the benefit of Ellen Burstyn's direction on the set, which is a little psychotic, which is, you know, it seems like a little obsessive.
Well, Scorsese is perhaps unique among directors who he has a reputation of being both a control freak, but also being generally nice.
Exactly.
At least to the crew and the actors. He's got a famous temper, which most of the stories involving Scorsese's temper are directed at the suits, so to speak. But, you know, there's not a lot of stories of Scorsese being a major asshole on
set. Exactly.
But he is, you know, he is a control freak.
He is a control freak.
Which I suppose is true of most directors.
To a large extent.
Unless you're Michael Bay.
Certainly auteurs, and he's certainly an auteur. And this was, and another funny thing, sort of a control thing that Marty was learning right around that time, is that he brought Ellen Burstyn in to watch a rough cut of the, early rough cut of the film, and she instantly came up with various suggestions for the film. And since, and Marty swore at that time that this was going to be the last time he ever brought in any actor into the edit room with him, and I think he's kind of stuck to that.
Wow.
For the most part. So that was a big lesson for him. But his very next project, of course...
Hold on, real quick. Again, having not seen Alice, I will say, in terms of Scorsese's overall career, it's maybe the first example where Ellen Burstyn, I guess, would be the person who saw Marty's... how great actors were in Scorsese films. So people saw Mean Streets and saw the performances. Ellen Burstyn had this script and said, all right, I've got this movie. If I do this right, I'm going to win an Oscar for this thing. So she picks the director of Mean Streets, figuring this guy can help her. And he did. It worked. She won the Oscar for that. Scorsese in later years became, he has a reputation of almost some sort of acting kingmaker, where people like Sharon Stone in Casino, maybe Cameron Diaz, even Leonardo DiCaprio.
Absolutely.
Where Scorsese's has this very well-deserved reputation as a great director of actors, to the point where actors who were looking to show their range, maybe actors who weren't taken seriously, who would like to be taken seriously, one of the ways to do that is they're like, man, I gotta get in a Scorsese movie. Because that guy is gonna make me look great. And yes. Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore maybe is the first example of that.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, there's no question about it. And you know, I guess Ellen Burstyn deserves a lot of credit for being able to kind of notice that. Unfortunately, she never made another appearance in another Scorsese movie, so that kind of goes to show you that that may, well, probably was not the best
relationship. Well, it's also, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore is also, geez, I'm looking at the film. Would you say it's the only movie with a female lead?
Arguably, I mean, you could certainly say that in Age of Innocence, there is some, you could argue that there is a female co-lead.
But that's still, it's very much from a male point of view.
I agree with you. I would say that is his ultimate woman's picture. So, yes, Alice Does Not Live Here Anymore is Scorsese's most feminine film.
Early 30s, Martin Scorsese apparently decided he'd had enough of that and moved back into the familiar machismo that we all know.
That's right. And instantly with his very next film, which of course is the seminal Taxi Driver. And well, Taxi Driver, you know, so much has been said about that film. But, you know, what really stands out for me about Taxi Driver is, well, a few things. First of all, the film holds up wonderfully. I mean, it is, you know, it's one of those mid-70s movies that really, really as pertinent now as it was back then. All the political stuff is still dead on. But, you know, I think the reason it's great is that it's just, you know, what Scorsese did in that film, along with Schrader, is they deconstructed the Hollywood protagonist. And that's why I think the movie holds up so well. You know, if you break down Taxi Driver, it's a story of a veteran of a war who comes back home and kind of finds himself a little bit useless in normal society, and ends up enlisting his abilities, which frankly are, you know, being able to kill people by the dozen, to assist somebody who is experiencing some sort of injustice back home. And this is such a basic American protagonist. You can go throughout the history of film and you see that character. He could be played by John Wayne. He could be played by Jimmy Stewart. He could be played by anybody. And you just see him in film after film. The Searchers is certainly, you know,
it's the Rambo character.
Well, it's you know, amazingly, it's amazing you mentioned that, because, you know, you see the seismic impact that Taxi Driver had on cinema with that character. I mean, Travis Bickle reexamines that war, you know, that veteran who comes back home, and kind of skews the way we look at him. We still identify with Travis, amazingly. He's not particularly likable or funny. We're with him 100%, but we're also able to look at him from the side and realize that, you know, this guy is not right. This guy is a bit of a psychopath because of his, you know, kind of addiction to violence. I mean, you know, essentially Scorsese is saying that, you know, this type of character is kind of intrinsically mentally unstable, and we really should think twice about idealizing and idolizing these characters that we've come to accept as normal and absolutely, you know, honorable and worth our idolizing in all these previous films. You know, the Searchers is a prime example, because, you know, in the Searchers, it's a brilliant film that John Ford did, and he kind of goes there a little bit in the Searchers, because the Ethan character in the Searchers, exactly the same thing. He comes back from the war and then spends the next few years trying to track down his niece who was kidnapped by the Comanches. And what happens throughout the course of the film is you basically realize that this Ethan character is nutty. You know, I mean, he's kind of out of his mind, and he's, and you start suspecting that he's in fact a psychopath who is, once he finds his niece, and who obviously has been living as a concubine of the Comanche chief for all these years, the main drama becomes, is Ethan going to murder her? And, you know, and it's the same kind of thing with, with a taxi driver. He just kind of goes much more deeply in it, and it's much more explicit in that kind of examination of the thing. But Rambo is a prime example. Exactly. The Rambo character in the first Rambo movie, before he became a cartoon in the second Rambo movie, you know, Rambo character was very much a Travis Bickle type character. He, you know, he dressed exactly the same, right? I mean, you see, it was the, wore the same basic costume as Travis Bickle.
And that was after, I'm pretty sure, right?
Well, yeah, of course, yeah. The First Blood came out like in, I think...
78 or something?
No. First Blood is like 84. It's much later. It's quite it's an 80s movie, yeah. And First Blood, you know, you have the same character who's a war vet, who's a real outsider. And instead of... In Taxi Driver, you know, eventually once Travis goes nuts, he basically kills a bunch of gangsters and pimps trying to save the young girl, Iris, who is, you know, this teenage prostitute. So he's trying to sort of save her the same way that John Wayne was trying to save his niece in The Searchers. Ends up just murdering all these people, but in fact is branded a hero by the press because they are, in fact, criminals. Well, in First Blood, similar situation, except Rambo turns his wrath on the local police department of some small town and just ends up killing a whole bunch of people in that regard. And what's funny is that in the movie, he's not portrayed particularly heroic. But somehow in the national consciousness, we have elevated him to the level of heroism. And it's just funny to watch that movie and you go, wow, somebody really, really missed what the deal with that character is. But very much a post-Travis Bickle kind of creation. And, you know, and so, you know, in fact, that sort of a reexamination of the protagonist is, you know, makes that film... you know, it gives that film a lot of impact and makes it very influential on, you know, on modern cinema.
The other thing I would add just historically about Taxi Driver is, to me, Taxi Driver is exhibit A about how Hollywood was a little different in the 70s. That, you know, everyone talks, again, it's one of those cliches that's a cliche because it's true, that in the 70s there was this window of time where, you know, not the independent films, but the major Hollywood studios were bankrolling these really interesting, personal, experimental films. Turn right, yes. And to me, the number one example is the fact that Taxi Driver is a studio picture. And right. Here we are, 30-some years later, and Taxi Driver is still fairly shocking, particularly the bloodbath at the end.
Exactly.
And the idea that you could ever get... say Warner Brothers or Paramount to bankroll that movie these days seems just ludicrous. I mean, just if I walked into a studio, you know, I hesitate to imagine Steven Spielberg could walk in with that script and get that film funded by one of the major Hollywood studios. And yet it was. I mean, Taxi Driver is not an independent film.
No, it's not an independent film.
It's a big old, like, you know, imagine this summer we've got the next Batman, Iron Man 3, and Taxi Driver, about a loner cab driver who's out to defend the life of an underage prostitute. I mean, it's absurd to imagine, but it happened. It really happened.
It is almost hard to imagine. But, you know, it was very difficult production for Marty. The movie almost got an X rating for its violence. There's very little sex in the film, and, of course, sex is an issue, I think. One of those things, of course, as he doesn't feel particularly comfortable with.
No, there's not a lot of...
He's not a very sexual filmmaker, and that's fine, you know, because that's not his... It's not his bag. It's not where his concern is. But in Taxi Driver, the movie almost nearly got an X rating, and they had to trim somewhat, especially, you know, the ending... action sequences, if you can call it that, because there was a serious threat that, you know, that the board was going to give it an X, and the studio, of course, could not have that, because an X essentially, you know, it cuts your profit by like 80%. So there was a lot of confrontation with the studio about the film's ending. Marty kind of got his way for the most part and got the ending he wanted. And, you know, and the other interesting thing for me is, despite the incredible violence, there's aspects of Taxi Driver which to me are very funny, very humorous. I don't know if you find that, but I mean, there's parts of Taxi Driver I really find fairly hilarious, and I think they're very intentional, and that's another one of those things that I really like about Scorsese, is that his movies are not dreary. I mean, there's a strong humorous streak to a lot of what he does, and even though it's usually kind of dark humor, nonetheless, it's, you know, he is not a humorless filmmaker, even though he certainly does not have a lot of comedies under his belt. Right?
No, but it is true. For all of, you know, Scorsese very much, with the exception of Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, all his films are from a male point of view. Many of them deal with, turn right here, very macho and or violent men. He deals with that world. For all that, though, he's not Sean Penn. He is not a humorless chronicler of, you know, what it means to be macho in this world.
That's right.
I mean, and part of that, as we said, is that's who Scorsese is. I mean, Scorsese was not, you know, Scorsese's not a tough guy. Scorsese's a sickly, short dude.
Yes, yes. But he grew up around a lot of violence.
He did. He's aware of it. He's a chronicler of that world.
Exactly.
But unlike, you know, we always talk about Sean Penn often being humorless. That's probably because Sean Penn wishes to be a participant in that.
Right, exactly.
Less a chronicler as a celebrant.
Exactly, exactly. And whereas Scorsese has a outsider's perspective on it from the inside, in a sense, and also the ability to poke fun at it, to laugh at it, to see its attractive side, to see its humorous side, and to kind of criticize it a little bit. And all of his best work has that humorous streak that's really, really, I think it's biting, and I think is a little bit underappreciated to a large degree. And I think, you know, next time you watch Taxi Driver or Goodfellas or Casino or any of those films, there is genuine humor in that film. Some of it is creepy, but by God, it's certainly not without laughs. And, the next film, of course, Scorsese goes into is New York, New York. And New York, New York has actually quite a few laughs in it, even though it's a very, very dark film about jazz and drug addiction and all kinds of stuff. And, of course, it coincides with Scorsese's own bouts with drug addiction right around that time. Like most of Hollywood, Scorsese got heavily into cocaine. And it sort of became his muse for a while, and he had some major problems, and he almost OD'd one time, almost died, and ended up in the hospital. So cocaine became a major part of Scorsese's life and a major part of his creativity, and you see it very, very clearly the way he sort of examines the mindset of the drug addiction in New York, New York. What's your take on New York, New York, Steve?
My take is my expert preparation for this. I've never seen the film.
You've never seen New York, New York. Very, very much worth seeing. Yeah, New York, New York is, I really like the film. You know,
So you think it gets a bad rap? Because again, speaking as someone who's not seen it, it is historically considered one of the low points of Scorsese's career. The moment where his upward trajectory just fell apart.
Right.
Enabling the redemption of Raging Bull.
Absolutely. I think that sort of fits the, you know, the story. I think just taken on its own, it's a very entertaining film. It's a musical, and Scorsese is one of those guys who loves music. Music is an extremely important part of all of his films, and here Scorsese essentially tries to do a modernist musical, a movie in which music is not sort of an artificial thing pasted on top of some corny story, as was the case in most Hollywood musicals, but an actual driving force of its characters. So, you know, again, starring De Niro, who at this point is now Scorsese's leading man officially, and the wonderful Liza Minnelli, of course, now the butt of everybody's jokes, but kind of a fine actress in her own right, certainly doing great work in that movie. And it's you know, New York is a tragedy, and it's just, you know, it's a tragedy about like two people who just cannot overcome their demons, basically, is what it comes down to. And we've seen it before, but the movie, taken on its own merits, is it's extremely watchable. It is definitely a filmmaker working at the height of his prowess. The film is not without problems, and of course, because it followed Taxi Driver, which is so original and so seminal, I think it's almost inevitable that the movie was a little bit of a letdown for a lot of people who were expecting more sort of gritty, you know, punk rock aesthetic from Scorsese, and he wasn't going there. He wanted to depart from that, and he did New York, and he then slid right into The Last Waltz, which was one of his musical concert films.
Well, one of the great things about Scorsese, which everyone kind of accepts now, but you can still see people have problems with, is that Scorsese is not just a lover of John Cassavetes films. He's also a lover of MGM musicals.
Absolutely.
And, you know, historical epics. Young Scorsese loved Ben-Hur. And so Scorsese, once he started to get a reputation and people willing to give him more money, he's like, well, I'll make a musical.
He'll try anything. He'll absolutely try anything. And the documentary, you know, The Last Waltz, you know, people really love that film. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the band, so I never really loved The Last Waltz, but The Last Waltz is a wonderful snapshot of that period in, like, mainstream American music, you know, where all of these people were, like, obsessed with this sort of country rock and, you know, and were doing a lot of cocaine and were just playing a lot of, you know, really interesting music, and at the same time knew that that period of time, which was kind of a holdover from the 60s, was coming to the end. So The Last Waltz is a wonderful example of that. And it's a beautifully shot concert film. I mean, it's really, really cool and very influential, obviously. After The Last Waltz, of course, Scorsese goes into Raging Bull, arguably one of his best films, if not the best film.
The second of the three in the canon. Andre and I... Okay, I'm going to cut this out here. Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the things about Scorsese is, regardless of, you know, even if you hate Scorsese, it's hard to argue that Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and Goodfellas are not kind of in the canon of American films. That they're major, major works that you have to at least deal with if you're going to have a serious discussion about, you know, what are some of the greatest American films.
Absolutely.
So... You know, that's three from one guy, which is, that's a high batting average for anybody.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it's really amazing.
You know, and then you throw in Mean Streets, which again, almost an honorary first movie. It's one of the great independent films.
Exactly. At a point when making an independent film actually meant something.
It was huge.
Opposed to now, where I could shoot an independent film with my iPhone.
Yes. You know?
So,
But anyway, so Raging Bull, the second kind of agreed upon consensus masterpiece.
Absolutely. And Raging Bull...
Yeah, what? I don't have a ton to add about. I don't feel it is underrated. I think Raging Bull is great.
It's pretty much
most
rated.
If you've never seen it, most of the things you've heard about it are true.
Right. Also, I mean, another collaboration with Paul Schrader, even though the film's attributed to several writers and a lot of people were involved in it. Originally, De Niro brought the initial concept to Scorsese while Scorsese was working on Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. And Scorsese just kind of put it off and, you know, wasn't initially interested, but then kind of got into it and started working on it. I think Schrader eventually came up with a concept that Scorsese really, really identified with. And that was essentially, the relationship, the central relationship in the film is not between Jake LaMotta, the, you know, the compromised boxer, the nearly psychotic, you know, violence addicted protagonist of the film, and his wife, which a lot of people feel that it is, but in my opinion, it's, you know, the core of the film obviously is the is Jake's relationship with his brother Joey, who's also a former boxer and is LaMotta's manager, and this is really the heart of the film, and it's the heart of the film that took them a while to find in the screenplay process, and it was Schrader who found it, because it kind of represented Schrader's relationship with his own brother, and Marty identified with it because Marty too had a brother with whom he had a very contentious relationship, and once they figured that out, the movie just really, really started clicking together. But again, not an easy production.
Well, it was Scorsese's, look at my notes here, it's his first adaptation.
That's right. It was based on a book.
Everything else had been an original screenplay. And again, based on facts or this or that, but Raging Bull was, they actually had a book they were working from.
That's right.
And stylistically, I also want to note, it's one of two movies Scorsese made with the cinematographer Michael Chapman.
That's right.
They made two movies together. One of them is the crazy color-saturated Taxi Driver. Right. And the other one is one of the great modern black-and-white films, Raging Bull.
Absolutely.
So a little hat tip to Michael Chapman for two very distinct, influential looks.
Yeah, Chapman's brilliant cinematographer, and absolutely, just that is a beautiful film without any doubt. Interestingly enough, Scorsese during the production of the film was not really enamored with Chapman, and his main problem is he just felt Chapman was taking an incredibly long time to set up shots, and the story goes that Scorsese would sort of run back to his trailer and hang out and just listen to a lot of Clash. He was really into the Clash at the time. And he would sit there, and if it would take longer than a side of a Clash album to light a scene, he would run out and just screaming at Chapman, what's taking so long, Mike? What's taking so long? Get going, come on. And so this was like a common aspect of the film that everybody seems to remember, is like Marty trying to hurry Chapman along, who just kind of casually went about his business and drove Marty a little bit nuts, and I'm sure did not help his cocaine intake.
Similar to Taxi Driver 2, that film, even to this day, given the changing standards, that's still an incredibly violent picture. A lot of it is just focusing on the carnage of the fights and the blood.
Yeah.
And in the commercial video world, there's a trick that when you're editing footage of surgery or things with blood, you can turn down the color to make the footage black and white. It's easier to stomach,
right,
easier to deal with. That is not the case in Raging Bull, that despite being in black and white, the blood is thick and copious and... Yeah, if you're not a lover of violent movies, if that disturbs you, then I'd like to not recommend Raging Bull.
Absolutely. I think people that are turned off by violence are generally not big Scorsese fans. I mean, Scorsese is a master of film violence, and he's interesting in the regard because he does not... his stuff does not really glorify violence. It doesn't, he's not known for elaborate action sequences. His violence is scary.
Yes, most of the violence in Scorsese movies, it is. It is not the type of war movie violence where you say, wow, that's bad, but that looks cool. In Scorsese movies, whenever there is violence, someone gets hurt badly.
Yes, very, very much so, and you kind of feel every punch in and out of the ring in Raging Bull. It's just a brilliant film. If you haven't seen it, of course, you have to see it. Strangely enough, of course, Raging Bull did not get any love from the Academy. It was nominated for Best Picture, I believe, but it certainly did not win. What won that year? Do you remember what?
Ordinary People.
Ordinary People won. So
also took Best Director.
Took Best Director to Robert Redford. Ordinary People, a fine film. I think you have to be a mental midget to at this point say that it is a better film than Raging Bull, which I guess is some kind of a final comment on the viability of Best Picture Oscars. Anyway, the following film Scorsese did, he did King of Comedy, After Hours, the aptly titled Color of Money, and The Last Temptation of Christ. What stands out of that group for you, Steve?
Well, clearly The Last Temptation of Christ. The whole 80s period historically is Scorsese kind of coming to terms with the 70s being over. That the days of him being able to go to a major Hollywood studio with a quirky independent script and have it get financed, those days were gone. So he tried to adapt. And with The Color of Money, he kind of made some money and made his personal project, which was The Last Temptation of Christ. That is a great, great film, I feel. When we talk about Scorsese, you know, there are the three consensus masterpieces. You know, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and Goodfellas. And then there are the films you can argue about.
Right.
And, you know, if you were studying Scorsese and you say, all right, start with those three maybe, but then I would put The Last Temptation of Christ in, you know, the next category of, I think that's a great, great film. It's very unique. I don't know another film like that. It's a slightly strange movie that when the first time you see it, you're maybe not quite sure how to feel about it. And then it's a movie that stays with you. And afterwards, you're thinking, you know, it just comes back to you a lot. There's a lot of cool things in that movie that you can tell were very personal. Things in that movie that Scorsese has talked about. He would come up with certain images or sequences that he had in his head for, you know, literally decades before he got to put them on film.
Yeah, it's an amazing film. I agree with you. I mean, Last Temptation of Christ is definitely the best of this group of films that I just mentioned. I'm not a huge fan of King of Comedy. I love After Hours, but it's a minor film. It's a film Scorsese did essentially almost as a favor to a friend of his who was producing and starring in the film. And I just love it. It's one of his few comedies. The King of Comedy is actually not a comedy and is not particularly funny, to be honest with you, although, again, it does have a fairly solid comedic performance from De Niro, who that may be his first comedic performance.
Scorsese has once said that he thought that was the best performance De Niro has ever given him.
It's an interesting theory, and I'm not gonna say I agree with it. But King of Comedy is a bit of a problematic film. After Hours is again. Really, really film that I personally enjoy. I was quite obsessed with when I was in college. Used to watch it all the time. And
After Hours is also noted the first film he made with cinematographer Michael Bauhaus.
Michael Bauhaus.
Am I saying that right? Bauhaus?
I believe so, the German cinematographer.
And he made seven films with Scorsese.
That's right. It's one of his...
Including four in a row, starting with After Hours. So that is a great, great collaboration, I feel. They made some great pictures together. So.
Yep. Absolutely.
If nothing else, that film introduced those two men.
That's right. That's right. And beautifully shot film. And I think those two are very good fit. I believe as director cinematographer goes. But of course, Michael Bauhaus now is extremely elderly, so it's kind of difficult to run around at his advanced age. But Color of Money was, you know, again, it was a sequel to The Hustler. It is not as good as The Hustler. It is.
Is this the first of the Scorsese movies that are primarily designed to make money, would you say?
Well, I mean, you could, I guess you could say Boxcar Bertha was the first of those films, but yeah, I would say that this is Scorsese acting as a hired gun to a large degree.
Yes.
You know, and you know, it's a fine film, it's watchable, it's entertaining, a lot of
and
it is shot in Chicago.
It got Paul Newman as Oscar.
That's right.
It made Scorsese a bunch of money and mm-hmm. allowed him to finally make The Last Temptation of Christ.
That's right. And it put Tom Cruise into the leagues of the big boys. Tom Cruise was now doing serious work with serious acting partners and
same
year
as Top Gun, I believe.
Exactly. And he's very good in the film, actually, quite good. But Last Temptation of Christ is without a doubt, you know, the best of this group of films. And you know, what's great about Last Temptation of Christ, it was a very controversial film because obviously if you do anything, you know, on a religious theme, there's going to be controversy. People were I remember when the film came out. I was in college, and there were actually even, you know, even in a, you know, liberal college town, people were protesting the film and calling it offensive. You know, I saw the film. I was trying to sort of gauge just how offensive it is, which was difficult for me not being Christian. But, I didn't see it. I found it to be a very respectful film of Christ. I thought it nailed what Christ was all about in my view, and it seemed and it kind of clarified why people followed the philosophy of Christ. So I mean, I thought it was a very, very deeply spiritual and very, very well made film. And and amazingly, for a film that was set in Israel 2,000 years ago, it was very much a Scorsese film. It felt like, it felt very consistent with Scorsese's canon. It did not feel like it was a stylistic departure from him. It was a thematic departure, perhaps, but certainly not a stylistic. It really feels like a quintessential Scorsese film, except everybody's wearing sandals.
And the tone of the film is... realistic is the wrong word, because it certainly has a dream logic to it, and all the images in the film are very impressionistic.
Uh-huh.
But there is a grittiness to it.
Absolutely.
That it is, the characters in that world are dirty.
Exactly. They're dirty, and they're the passion of it, the emotionality of it, it all makes sense. And of course, Harvey Keitel's presence ties it all together, and there was a lot of criticism of when the film came out of how over the top Keitel is in that film with his big red wig and just him screaming all his lines at the top of his voice. I think he's friggin' great in that movie.
He is great, and it was well cast, because both in just delivery and whole acting styles, Keitel is very different from Willem Dafoe, who of course plays Jesus. Another Schrader script.
Mm-hmm. And another novelization,
yes.
Based on a great novel by a Greek author, Katsakis, whose name I probably am mispronouncing, but actually it's a great book. The movie, from what I understand, is very, very faithful to the book.
It is. I have read the book. I was borderline obsessed with the whole project for a little bit in high school. That I read the book, I saw the movie. And yes, it is very, very faithful to the tone of the book. And yeah, it's a very personal Scorsese film. I think it's a great film anyway.
That, exactly.
Regardless of your religious leanings, it's a very fascinating film that anybody should take a look at.
Yeah, it's definitely worth watching, and very watchable on multiple viewings as well. Great music as well. Peter Gabriel did a fantastic job scoring this film. Of course, now we get to what is probably Scorsese's most popular film amongst most people, and that's Goodfellas. Here is just Scorsese getting back to New York, getting back to the mob, and he has actually argued that there's an actual trilogy in his film catalog, starting with Mean Streets, that deals with a very low-level mobster wannabes, moving to Goodfellas, which deals with sort of mid-level mobsters, and then ending with Casino, which deals with the real high-end guys who run Las Vegas casinos. And there's a case to be made here, but Goodfellas, again, this is one of those films, most people love it. It is unbelievably entertaining, incredibly watchable. Most people can quote, scenes wholesale from the film. Just brilliantly structured, very, again, entertaining is really what it comes down to. I don't know if you could say, for example, Raging Bull is entertaining in a conventional sense, but Goodfellas, boy.
Yes. Raging Bull, depending on your mood, there are bits of it that can be a little bit of a slog, and it's heavy going.
Mm-hmm.
Taxi Driver, the same thing. Both of those films are very controlled pieces about disturbed men. It's not always fun. Goodfellas zips right along.
Oh, yeah.
A strong contender for my favorite film, if I had to pick a film. And the main reason for that is just pacing. That, you know, it's like 2.5 hours, and even at that length, it's one of the better paced movies I've ever seen.
It just flies by. It's very episodic. It doesn't follow a straight line. Another adaptation, this is a biography of this, you know, this whacked out mobster named Henry Hill, who's still around, just barely, and you see him popping up occasionally on Howard Stern or various other, you know, unusual outlets, and he's quite a character, and he, you know, he spent a lot of time with Ray Liotta, who's the star of the film, along with De Niro and Joe Pesci, and you know, I mean, again, just a runaway train, just a fantastically fun movie to watch. You know, I will say there is the not to overstate the film's originality. In recent years, I've become a fan of a Japanese filmmaker named Kenji Fukusaku, who specialized in Japanese gangster films, the Yakuza films, and he these films for a long time were not available in the U.S., and I think a while ago I even said this to you, Steve, I saw the Fukusaku gangster films, the Yakuza Papers. It was is a particularly like a, you know, like a six-part masterpiece on the Yakuza, and I have to say that Scorsese stole quite liberally from Fukusaku, stylistically speaking, especially in terms of freeze frames and the way the violence is treated, you know, just the way that he uses the camera. So, having seen the Fukusaku gangster films, I have lost a little bit of a respect for Goodfellas from the originality perspective. I think, you know, I think Scorsese does, like everybody else, definitely, you know, well, let's say borrows from other filmmakers, and in this case, he borrowed from a filmmaker he didn't quite feel like he needed to disguise his borrowing quite so much.
I've never heard Scorsese talk about that, that particular filmmaker, which is the only part about that story that maybe disturbs me a little bit. Because, to be honest, a lot of times I find originality overrated when it comes to those things. I mean, I don't like things that are just complete homages to other films. But at the same time, if you treat cinema like a language, sometimes people come up with new ways of speaking, different techniques. So then what you do is you incorporate those techniques into your own filmmaking vocabulary and use them appropriately. And that is where Scorsese is great, and where some of the Scorsese imitators fail, that they think if you can just put an homage to this or that great film, or even copy something Scorsese did, that automatically equals a great film. And Scorsese's cinema knowledge is so vast, but he also has great taste about knowing when to apply certain techniques.
Exactly, exactly.
And Goodfellas is just a masterpiece to me of taking all the tools in his, you know, bag of tricks, which is very large at this point, and just applying them, you know, it's a masterpiece of how to make a movie.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's hard, you know, it's so incredibly influential. I mean, there's literally people have made whole careers out of imitating Goodfellas, not necessarily in the genre, but just in its approach and its vibe and its, you know, overall feel. And, you know, it's great. And arguably, you could say that it's the last great Scorsese film. Would you agree with that assessment, Steve? It's kind of controversial, but that's really how I feel. I think this is the last genuinely great Scorsese film, because the next film Scorsese moves
into... I've got one other on my list.
Okay.
Which, when we get there, I've got one other one which I personally find great, but it's certainly far and away the last consensus.
And this is the end of part one of our Martin Scorsese show. Tune in for part two. I'm Andre Shane.
I'm Steve Haskin.
And this is Spoiler Alert.